utter falsehoods and live according to the dictates of your conscience. You can maintain your nobility, even when facing the ultimate threat, if you abide truthfully and courageously by the highest of ideals. You will be provided with more security and strength than will be offered by any short-sighted concentration on your own safety. If you live properly, fully, you can discover meaning so profound that it protects you even from the fear of death. Could all that possibly be true? Death, toil, and evil. The tragedy of self-conscious being produces suffering, inevitable suffering. That suffering, in turn, motivates the desire for selfish, immediate gratification, for expediency. But sacrifice and work serves far more effectively than short-term impulsive pleasure at keeping suffering at bay. However, tragedy itself, conceived of as the arbitrary harshness of society and nature set against the vulnerability of the individual, is not the only, and perhaps not even the primary, source of suffering. There's also the problem of evil to consider. The world is set hard against us, of a certainty, but man's inhumanity to man is something even worse. Thus, the problem of sacrifice is compounded in its complexity. It is not only privation and mortal limitation that must be addressed by work, by the willingness to offer and to give up. It is the problem of evil as well. Consider once again the story of Adam and Eve. Life becomes very hard for their children, that's us, after the fall and awakening of our archetypal parents. First is the terrible fate awaiting us in the post-paradisal world, in the world of history. Not the least of this is what Goethe called our creative endless toil. Humans work, as we have seen. We work because we have awakened to the truth of our own vulnerability, our subjugation to disease and death, and wish to protect ourselves for as long as possible. Once we can see the future, we must prepare for it, or live in denial and terror. We therefore sacrifice the pleasures of today for the sake of a better tomorrow. But the realization of mortality and the necessity of work is not the only revelation to Adam and Eve when they eat the forbidden fruit, wake up, and open their eyes. They were also granted, or cursed by, the knowledge of good and evil. It took me decades to understand what that means, to understand even part of what that means. It's this. Once you become consciously aware that you, yourself, are vulnerable, you understand the nature of human vulnerability in general. You understand what it's like to be fearful and angry and resentful and bitter. You understand what pain means. And once you truly understand such feelings in yourself and how they're produced, you understand how to produce them in others. It is in this manner that the self-conscious beings that we are become voluntarily and exquisitely capable of tormenting others, and ourselves, of course, but it's the others we are concerned about right now. We see the consequences of this new knowledge manifest themselves when we meet Cain and Abel, the sons of Adam and Eve. By the time of their appearance, mankind has learned to make sacrifices to God. On altars of stone designed for that purpose, a communal ritual is performed. The immolation of something valuable, a choice animal or portion thereof, and its transformation through fire to the smoke, to the spirit, that rises to heaven above. In this manner, the idea of delay is dramatized so that the future might improve. Abel's sacrifices are accepted by God, and he flourishes. Cain's, however, are rejected. He becomes jealous and bitter, and it's no wonder. If someone fails and is rejected because he refused to make any sacrifices at all, well, that's at least understandable. He may still feel resentful and vengeful, but knows in his heart that he is personally to blame. That knowledge generally places a limit on his outrage. It's much worse, however, if he had actually forgone the pleasures of the moment, if he had strived and toiled, and things still didn't work out, if he was rejected, despite his efforts. Then he's lost the present and the future. Then his work, his sacrifice, has been pointless. Under such conditions, the world darkens and the soul rebels. Cain is outraged by his rejection. He confronts God, accuses him, and curses his creation. That proves to be a very poor decision. God responds in no uncertain terms that the fault is all with Cain, and worse, that Cain has knowingly and creatively dallied with sin and reaped the consequences. This is not at all what Cain wanted to hear. It's by no means an apology on God's part. Instead, it's insult added to injury. Cain, embittered to the core by God's response, plots revenge. He defies the Creator audaciously. It's daring. Cain knows how to hurt. He's self-conscious, after all, and has become even more so in his suffering and shame. So he murders Abel in cold blood. He kills his brother, his own ideal, as Abel is everything Cain wishes to be. He commits this most terrible of crimes to spite himself, all of mankind, and God himself all at once. He does it to wreak havoc and gain his vengeance. He does it to register his fundamental opposition to existence, to protest the intolerable vagaries of being itself. And Cain's children, the offspring, as it were, of both his body and his decision, are worse. In his existential fury, Cain kills once. Lamech, his descendant, goes much further. "I have slain a man to my wounding," says Lamech, "and a young man to my hurt. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and 7-fold. Genesis 4:23-24. Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every artificer in brass and iron, Genesis 4:22, is by tradition 7 generations from Cain, and the first creator of weapons of war. And next in the Genesis stories comes the flood. The juxtaposition is by no means accidental. Evil enters the world with self-consciousness. The toil with which God curses Adam, that's bad enough. The trouble in childbirth with which Eve is burdened, and her consequent dependence on her husband, are no trivial matters either. They are indicative of the implicit and oft agonizing tragedies of insufficiency, privation, brute necessity, and subjugation to illness and death that simultaneously define and plague existence. Their mere factual reality is sometimes sufficient to turn even a courageous person against life. It has been my experience, however, that human beings are strong enough to tolerate the implicit tragedies of being without faltering, without breaking, or worse, breaking bad. I've seen evidence of this repeatedly in my private life, in my work as a professor, and in my role as a clinical practitioner. Earthquakes, floods, poverty, cancer, we're tough enough to take on all of that. But human evil adds a whole new dimension of misery to the world. It is for this reason that the rise of self-consciousness and its attendant realization of mortality and knowledge of good and evil is presented in the early chapters of Genesis and in the vast tradition that surrounds them as a cataclysm of cosmic magnitude. Conscious human malevolence can break the spirit even tragedy could not shake. I remember discovering, with her, that one of my clients had been shocked into years of serious post-traumatic stress disorder, daily physical shaking and terror, and chronic nightly insomnia, by the mere expression on her enraged, drunken boyfriend's face. His fallen countenance, Genesis 4:5, indicated his clear and conscious desire to do her harm. She was more naive than she should have been, and that predisposed her to the trauma. But that's not the point. The voluntary evil we do one another can be profoundly and permanently damaging, even to the strong. And what is it precisely that motivates such evil? It doesn't make itself manifest merely in consequence of the hard lot of life. It doesn't even emerge simply because of failure itself, or because of the disappointment and bitterness that failure often and understandably engenders. But the hard lot of life, magnified by the consequence of continually rejected sacrifices, however poorly conceptualized, however half-heartedly executed, that will bend and twist people into the truly monstrous forms who then begin consciously to work evil, who then begin to generate for themselves and others little besides pain and suffering, and who do it for the sake of that pain and suffering. In that manner, a truly vicious circle takes hold. Begrudging sacrifice, half-heartedly undertaken. Rejection of that sacrifice by God or by reality, take your pick. Angry resentment generated by that rejection. Descent into bitterness and the desire for revenge. Sacrifice undertaken even more begrudgingly or refused altogether. And it's hell itself that serves as the destination place of that downward spiral. Life is indeed nasty, brutish, and short, as the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes so memorably remarked. But man's capacity for evil makes it worse. This means that the central problem of life, the dealing with its brute facts, is not merely what and how to sacrifice to diminish suffering, but what and how to sacrifice to diminish suffering and evil, the conscious and voluntary and vengeful source of the worst suffering. The story of Cain and Abel is one manifestation of the archetypal tale of the hostile brothers, hero and adversary, the two elements of the individual human psyche, one aimed up at the good and the other down at hell itself. Abel is a hero, true, but a hero who is ultimately defeated by Cain. Abel could please God, a non-trivial and unlikely accomplishment, but he could not overcome human evil. For this reason, Abel is archetypally incomplete. Perhaps he was naive, although a vengeful brother can be inconceivably treacherous and subtle, like the snake in Genesis 3:1. But excuses, even reasons, even understandable reasons, don't matter, not in the final analysis. The problem of evil remained unsolved even by the divinely acceptable sacrifices of Abel. It took thousands of additional years for humanity to come up with anything else resembling a solution. The same issue emerges again in its culminating form, in the story of Christ and his temptation by Satan. But this time it's expressed more comprehensively, and the hero wins. Evil confronted. Jesus was led into the wilderness, according to the story, to be tempted by the devil, Matthew 4:1, prior to his crucifixion. This is the story of Cain, restated abstractly. Cain is neither content nor happy, as we have seen. He's working hard, or so he thinks, but God is not pleased. Meanwhile, Abel is, by all appearances, dancing his way through life. His crops flourish. Women love him. Worst of all, he's a genuinely good man. Everyone knows it. He deserves his good fortune. All the more reason to envy and hate him. Things do not progress well for Cain, by contrast, and he broods on his misfortune like a vulture on an egg. He strives in his misery to give birth to something hellish, and in doing so enters the desert wilderness of his own mind. He obsesses over his ill fortune, his betrayal by God. He nourishes his resentment. He indulges in ever more elaborate fantasies of revenge. And as he does so, his arrogance grows to Luciferian proportions. I'm ill-used and oppressed, he thinks. This is a stupid, bloody planet. As far as I'm concerned, it can go to hell. And with that, Cain encounters Satan in the wilderness for all intents and purposes, and falls prey to his temptations. And he does what he can to make things as bad as possible, motivated by, in John Milton's imperishable words, so deep a malice to confound the race of mankind in one root, and earth with hell to mingle and involve, done all to spite the great Creator. Cain turns to evil to obtain what good denied him, and he does it voluntarily, self-consciously, and with malice aforethought. Christ takes a different path. His sojourn in the desert is the dark night of the soul, a deeply human and universal human experience. It's the journey to that place each of us goes when things fall apart. Friends and family are distant. Hopelessness and despair reign, and black nihilism beckons. And let us suggest, in testament to the exactitude of the story, 40 days and nights starving alone in the wilderness might take you exactly to that place. It is in such a manner that the objective and subjective worlds come crashing synchronistically together. 40 days is a deeply symbolic period of time, echoing the 40 years the Israelites spent wandering in the desert after escaping the tyranny of Pharaoh and Egypt. 40 days is a long time in the underworld of dark assumptions, confusion, and fear, long enough to journey to the very center, which is hell itself. A journey there to see the sights can be undertaken by anyone. Anyone, that is, who is willing to take the evil of self and man with sufficient seriousness, a bit of familiarity with history can help. A sojourn through the totalitarian horrors of the 20th century, with its concentration camps, forced labor, and murderous ideological pathologies, is as good a place as any to start. That, and some consideration of the fact that the worst of the concentration camp guards were human, all too human, too. That's all part of making the desert story real again, part of updating it for the modern mind. After Auschwitz, said Theodor Adorno, student of authoritarianism, there should be no poetry. He was wrong, but the poetry should be about Auschwitz. In the grim wake of the last 10 decades of the previous millennium, the terrible destructiveness of man has become a problem whose seriousness self-evidently dwarfs even the problem of unredeemed suffering. And neither one of those problems is going to be solved in the absence of a solution to the other. This is where the idea of Christ's taking on the sins of mankind as if they were his own becomes key, opening the door to deep understanding of the desert encounter with the devil himself. Homo sum, humani nihil a me alienem puto, said the Roman playwright Terence. Nothing human is alien to me. No tree can grow to heaven, adds the ever-terrifying Carl Gustav Jung, psychoanalyst extraordinaire, unless its roots reach down to hell. Such a statement should give everyone who encounters it pause. There was no possibility for movement upward in that great psychiatrist's deeply considered opinion without a corresponding move down. It is for this reason that enlightenment is so rare. Who is willing to do that? Do you really want to meet who's in charge at the very bottom of the most wicked thoughts? What did Eric Harris, mass murderer of the Columbine High School, write so incomprehensibly the very day prior to massacring his classmates? It's interesting when I'm in my human form, knowing I'm going to die. Everything has a touch of triviality to it. Who would dare explain such a missive, or worse, explain it away? In the desert, Christ encounters Satan. See Luke 4:1-13 and Matthew 4:1-11. This story has a clear psychological meaning, a metaphorical meaning, in addition to whatever else material and metaphysical alike it might signify. It means that Christ is forever he who determines to take personal responsibility for the full depth of human depravity. It means that Christ is eternally he who is willing to confront and deeply consider and risk the temptations posed by the most malevolent elements of human nature. It means that Christ is always he who is willing to confront evil consciously, fully, and voluntarily, in the form that dwelt simultaneously within him and in the world. This is nothing merely abstract, although it is abstract, nothing to be brushed over. It's no merely intellectual matter. Soldiers who develop post-traumatic stress disorder frequently develop it not because of something they saw, but because of something they did. There are many demons, so to speak, on the battlefield. Involvement in warfare is something that can open a gateway to hell. Now and then something climbs through and possesses some naive farm boy from Iowa, and he turns monstrous. He does something terrible. He rapes and kills the women and massacres the infants of My Lai, and he watches himself do it. And some dark part of him enjoys it, and that is the part that is most unforgettable. And later, he will not know how to reconcile himself with the reality about himself and the world that was then revealed. And no wonder. In the great and fundamental myths of ancient Egypt, the god Horus, often regarded as a precursor to Christ, historically and conceptually speaking, experienced the same thing when he confronted his evil uncle Set, usurper of the throne of Osiris, Horus's father. Horus, the all-seeing Egyptian falcon god, the Egyptian eye of supreme eternal attention itself, has the courage to contend with Set's true nature, meeting him in direct combat. In the struggle with his dread uncle, however, his consciousness is damaged. He loses an eye. This is despite his godly stature and his unparalleled capacity for vision. What would a mere man lose who attempted the same thing? But perhaps he might gain an internal vision and understanding, something proportional to what he loses in perception of the outside world. Satan embodies the refusal of sacrifice. He is arrogance incarnate, spite, deceit, and cruel conscious malevolence. He is pure hatred of man, God, and being. He will not humble himself, even when he knows full well that he should. Furthermore, he knows exactly what he is doing, obsessed with the desire for destruction, and does it deliberately, thoughtfully, and completely. It has to be him, therefore, the very archetype of evil, who confronts and tempts Christ, the archetype of good. It must be him who offers to the Savior of mankind, under the most trying of conditions, what all men most ardently desire. Satan first tempts the starving Christ to quell his hunger by transforming the desert rocks into bread. Then he suggests that he throw himself off a cliff, calling on God and the angels to break his fall. Christ responds to the first temptation by saying, "One does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." What does this answer mean? It means that even under conditions of extreme privation, there are more important things than food. To put it another way, bread is of little use to the man who has betrayed his soul, even if he is currently starving. Christ could clearly use his near infinite power, as Satan indicates, to gain bread now to break his fast, even in the broader sense, to gain wealth in the world, which would theoretically solve the problem of bread more permanently. But at what cost? And to what gain? Gluttony in the midst of moral desolation? That's the poorest and most miserable of feasts. Christ aims, therefore, at something higher, at the description of a mode of being that would finally and forever solve the problem of hunger. If we all chose, instead of expedience, to dine on the Word of God, that would require each and every person to live and produce and sacrifice and speak and share in a manner that would permanently render the privation of hunger a thing of the past. And that's how the problem of hunger in the privations of the desert is most truly and finally addressed. There are other indications of this in the Gospels in dramatic, enacted form. Christ is continually portrayed as the purveyor of endless sustenance. He miraculously multiplies bread and fish. He turns water into wine. What does this mean? It's a call to the pursuit of higher meaning as the mode of living that is simultaneously most practical and of highest quality. It's a call portrayed in dramatic / literary form. Live as the archetypal Savior lives, and you and those around you will hunger no more. The beneficence of the world manifests itself to those who live properly. That's better than bread. That's better than the money that will buy bread. Thus, Christ, the symbolically perfect individual, overcomes the first temptation. Two more follow. Throw yourself off that cliff, Satan says, offering the next temptation. If God exists, he will surely save you. If you are in fact his son, God will surely save you. Why would God not make himself manifest to rescue his only begotten child from hunger and isolation and the presence of great evil? But that establishes no pattern for life. It doesn't even work as literature. The Deus ex machina, the emergence of a divine force that magically rescues the hero from his predicament, is the cheapest trick in the hack writer's playbook. It makes a mockery of independence and courage and destiny and free will and responsibility. Furthermore, God is in no wise a safety net for the blind. He's not someone to be commanded to perform magic tricks or forced into self-revelation, not even by his own son. Do not put the Lord your God to the test. Matthew 4:7. This answer, though rather brief, dispenses with the second temptation. Christ does not casually order or even dare ask God to intervene on his behalf. He refuses to dispense with his responsibility for the events of his own life. He refuses to demand that God prove his presence. He refuses, as well, to solve the problems of mortal vulnerability in a merely personal manner, by compelling God to save him, because that would not solve the problem for everyone else and for all time. There is also the echo of the rejection of the comforts of insanity in this foregone temptation. Easy but psychotic self-identification as the merely magical Messiah might well have been a genuine temptation under the harsh conditions of Christ's sojourn in the desert. Instead, he rejects the idea that salvation, or even survival in the shorter term, depends on narcissistic displays of superiority and the commanding of God, even by his son. Finally comes the third temptation, the most compelling of all. Christ sees the kingdoms of the world laid before him for the taking. That's the siren call of earthly power, the opportunity to control and order everyone and everything. Christ is offered the pinnacle of the dominance hierarchy, the animalistic desire of every naked ape, the obedience of all, the most wondrous of estates, the power to build and to increase, the possibility of unlimited sensual gratification. That's expedience writ large. But that's not all. Such expansion of status also provides unlimited opportunity for the inner darkness to reveal itself. The lust for blood, rape, and destruction is very much part of power's attraction. It is not only that men desire power so that they will no longer suffer. It is not only that they desire power so that they can overcome subjugation to want, disease, and death. Power also means the capacity to take vengeance, ensure submission, and crush enemies. Grant Cain enough power, and he will not only kill Abel, he will torture him first, imaginatively and endlessly. Then, and only then, will he kill him. Then he will come after everyone else. There's something above even the pinnacle of the highest of dominance hierarchies, access to which should not be sacrificed for mere proximal success. It's a real place, too, although not to be conceptualized in the standard geographical sense of place we typically use to orient ourselves. I had a vision once of an immense landscape, spread for miles out to the horizon before me. I was high in the air, granted a bird's-eye view. Everywhere I could see great, stratified, multi-storied pyramids of glass, some small, some large, some overlapping, some separate, all akin to modern skyscrapers, all full of people striving to reach each pyramid's very pinnacle. But there was something above that pinnacle, a domain outside each pyramid in which all were nested. That was the privileged position of the eye that could, or perhaps chose, to soar freely above the fray, that chose not to dominate any specific group or cause, but instead to somehow simultaneously transcend all. That was attention itself, pure and untrammeled, detached, alert, watchful attention, waiting to act when the time was right and the place had been established. As the Tao Te Ching has it, he who contrives defeats his purpose, and he who is grasping loses. The sage does not contrive to win, and therefore is not defeated. He is not grasping, so does not lose. There is a powerful call to proper being in the story of the third temptation. To obtain the greatest possible prize, the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth, the resurrection of paradise, the individual must conduct his or her life in a manner that requires the rejection of immediate gratification, of natural and perverse desires alike, no matter how powerfully and convincingly and realistically those are offered, and dispense as well with the temptations of evil. Evil amplifies the catastrophe of life, increasing dramatically the motivation for expediency already there because of the essential tragedy of being. Sacrifice of the more prosaic sort can keep that tragedy at bay, more or less successfully, but it takes a special kind of sacrifice to defeat evil. It is the description of that special sacrifice that has preoccupied the Christian, and more than Christian, imagination for centuries. Why has it not had the desired effect? Why do we remain unconvinced that there is no better plan than lifting our eyes skyward, aiming at the good, and sacrificing everything to that ambition? Have we merely failed to understand? Or have we fallen, willfully or otherwise, off the path? Christianity and its problems. Carl Jung hypothesized that the European mind found itself motivated to develop the cognitive technologies of science to investigate the material world, after implicitly concluding that Christianity, with its laser-like emphasis on spiritual salvation, had failed to sufficiently address the problem of suffering in the here and now. This realization became unbearably acute in the 3 or 4 centuries before the Renaissance. In consequence, a strange, profound, compensatory fantasy began to emerge deep in the collective Western psyche, manifesting itself first in the strange musings of alchemy, and developing only after many centuries into the fully articulated form of science. It was the alchemists who first seriously began to examine the transformations of matter, hoping to discover the secrets of health, wealth, and longevity. These great dreamers, Newton foremost among them, intuited and then imagined that the material world, damned by the church, held secrets the revelation of which could free humanity from its earthly pain and limitations. It was that vision, driven by doubt, that provided the tremendous collective and individual motivational power necessary for the development of science, with its extreme demands on individual thinkers for concentration and delay of gratification. This is not to say that Christianity, even in its incompletely realized form, was a failure. Quite the contrary. Christianity achieved the well-nigh impossible. The Christian doctrine elevated the individual soul, placing slave and master and commoner and nobleman alike on the same metaphysical footing, rendering them equal before God and the law. Christianity insisted that even the king was only one among many. For something so contrary to all apparent evidence to find its footing, the idea that worldly power and prominence were indicators of God's particular favor had to be radically de-emphasized. This was partly accomplished through the strange Christian insistence that salvation could not be obtained through effort or worth, through works. Whatever its limitations, the development of such doctrine prevented king, aristocrat, and wealthy merchant alike from lording it morally over the commoner. In consequence, the metaphysical conception of the implicit transcendent worth of each and every soul established itself against impossible odds as the fundamental presupposition of Western law and society. That was not the case in the world of the past, and is not the case yet in most places in the world of the present. It is in fact nothing short of a miracle, and we should keep this fact firmly before our eyes, that the hierarchical, slave-based societies of our ancestors reorganized themselves under the sway of an ethical/religious revelation, such that the ownership and absolute domination of another person came to be viewed as wrong. It would do as well to remember as well that the immediate utility of slavery is obvious, and that the argument that the strong should dominate the weak is compelling, convenient, and eminently practical, at least for the strong. This means that a revolutionary critique of everything slave-owning societies valued was necessary before the practice could be even questioned, let alone halted, including the idea that wielding power and authority made the slave owner noble, including the even more fundamental idea that the power wielded by the slave owner was valid and even virtuous. Christianity made explicit the surprising claim that even the lowliest person had rights, genuine rights, and that sovereign and state were morally charged at a fundamental level to recognize those rights. Christianity put forward explicitly the even more incomprehensible idea that the act of human ownership degraded the slaver, previously viewed as admirable nobility, much or even more than the slave. We fail to understand how difficult such an idea is to grasp. We forget that the opposite was self-evident throughout most of human history. We think that it is the desire to enslave and dominate that requires explanation. We have it backwards yet again. This is not to say that Christianity was without its problems, but it is more appropriate to note that they were the sort of problems that emerge only after an entirely different set of more serious problems has been solved. The society produced by Christianity was far less barbaric than the pagan, even the Roman, ones it replaced. Christian society at least recognized that feeding slaves to ravenous lions for the entertainment of the populace was wrong, even if many barbaric practices still existed. It objected to infanticide, to prostitution, and to the principle that might means right. It insisted that women were as valuable as men, even though we are still working out how to manifest that insistence politically. It demanded that even a society's enemies be regarded as human. Finally, it separated church from state so that all too human emperors could no longer claim the veneration due to gods. All of this was asking the impossible, but it happened. As the Christian Revolution progressed, however, the impossible problems it had solved disappeared from view. That's what happens to problems that are solved. And after the solution was implemented, even the fact that such problems had ever existed disappeared from view. Then, and only then, could the problems that remained, less amenable to quick solution by Christian doctrine, come to occupy a central place in the consciousness of the West, come to motivate, for example, the development of science, aimed at resolving the corporeal, material suffering that was still all too painfully extant within successfully Christianized societies. The fact that automobiles pollute only becomes a problem of sufficient magnitude to attract public attention when the far worse problems that the internal combustion engine solves have vanished from view. People stricken with poverty don't care about carbon dioxide. It's not precisely that CO2 levels are irrelevant. It's that they're irrelevant when you're working yourself to death, starving, scraping a bare living from the stony, unyielding, thorn and thistle infested ground. It's that they're irrelevant until after the tractor is invented and hundreds of millions stop starving. In any case, by the time Nietzsche entered the picture in the late 19th century, the problems Christianity had left unsolved had become paramount. Nietzsche described himself with no serious overstatement as philosophizing with a hammer. His devastating critique of Christianity, already weakened by its conflict with the very science to which it had given rise, involved two main lines of attack. Nietzsche claimed, first, that it was precisely the sense of truth developed in the highest sense by Christianity itself that ultimately came to question and then to undermine the fundamental presuppositions of the faith. That was partly because the difference between moral or narrative truth and objective truth had not yet been fully comprehended, and so an opposition was presumed where none necessarily exists, but that does not belie the point. Even when the modern atheists opposed to Christianity belittle fundamentalists for insisting, for example, that the creation account in Genesis is objectively true, they are using their sense of truth, highly developed over the centuries of Christian culture, to engage in such argumentation. Carl Jung continued to develop Nietzsche's arguments decades later, pointing out that Europe awoke during the Enlightenment as if from a Christian dream, noticing that everything it had heretofore taken for granted could and should be questioned. "God is dead," said Nietzsche. "God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we, murderers of all murderers, console ourselves? That which was the holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet possessed has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us?" The central dogmas of the Western faith were no longer credible, according to Nietzsche, given what the Western mind now considered truth. But it was his second attack on the removal of the true moral burden of Christianity during the development of the church that was most devastating. The hammer-wielding philosopher mounted an assault on an early established and then highly influential line of Christian thinking, that Christianity meant accepting the proposition that Christ's sacrifice, and only that sacrifice, had redeemed humanity. This did not mean, absolutely, that a Christian who believed that Christ died on the cross for the salvation of mankind was thereby freed from any and all personal moral obligation, but it did strongly imply that the primary responsibility for redemption had already been borne by the Savior, and that nothing too important to do remained for all too fallen human individuals. Nietzsche believed that Paul, and later the Protestants following Luther, had removed moral responsibility from Christ's followers. They had watered down the idea of the imitation of Christ. This imitation was the sacred duty of the believer, not to adhere or merely to mouth a set of statements about abstract belief, but instead to actually manifest the spirit of the Savior in the particular, specific conditions of his or her life, to realize or incarnate the archetype, as Jung had it, to clothe the eternal pattern in flesh. Nietzsche writes, "The Christians have never practiced the actions Jesus prescribed them, and the impudent, garrulous talk about the justification by faith and its supreme and sole significance is only the consequence of the church's lack of courage and will to profess the works Jesus demanded. Nietzsche was indeed a critic without parallel. Dogmatic belief in the central axioms of Christianity, that Christ's crucifixion redeemed the world, that salvation was reserved for the hereafter, that salvation could not be achieved through works, had three mutually reinforcing consequences. First, devaluation of the significance of earthly life, as only the hereafter mattered. This also meant that it had become acceptable to overlook and shirk responsibility for the suffering that existed in the here and now. Second, passive acceptance of the status quo, because salvation could not be earned in any case through effort in this life, a consequence that Marx also derided with his proposition that religion was the opiate of the masses. And, finally, third, the right of the believer to reject any real moral burden outside of the stated belief in salvation through Christ, because the Son of God had already done all the important work. It was for such reasons that Dostoevsky, who was a great influence on Nietzsche, also criticized institutional Christianity, although he arguably managed it in a more ambiguous, but also more sophisticated manner. In his masterwork, The Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky has his atheist Superman, Ivan, tell a little story. The Grand Inquisitor. A brief review is in order. Ivan speaks to his brother Alyosha, whose pursuits as a monastic novitiate he holds in contempt, of Christ returning to earth at the time of the Spanish Inquisition. The returning Savior makes quite a ruckus, as would be expected. He heals the sick, he raises the dead. His antics soon attract attention from the Grand Inquisitor himself, who promptly has Christ arrested and thrown into a prison cell. Later, the Inquisitor pays him a visit. He informs Christ that he is no longer needed. His return is simply too great a threat to the church. The Inquisitor tells Christ that the burden he laid on mankind, the burden of existence in faith and truth, was simply too great for mere mortals to bear. The Inquisitor claims that the church, in its mercy, diluted that message, lifting the demand for perfect being from the shoulders of its followers, providing them instead with the simple and merciful escapes of faith and the afterlife. That work took centuries, says the Inquisitor, and the last thing the church needs after all that effort is the return of the man who insisted that people bear all the weight in the first place. Christ listens in silence. Then, as the Inquisitor turns to leave, Christ embraces him and kisses him on the lips. The Inquisitor turns white in shock. Then he goes out, leaving the cell door open. The profundity of this story and the greatness of spirit necessary to produce it can hardly be exaggerated. Dostoevsky, one of the great literary geniuses of all time, confronted the most serious existential problems in all his great writings, and he did so courageously, headlong, and heedless of the consequences. Clearly Christian, he nonetheless adamantly refuses to make a straw man of his rationalist and atheistic opponents. Quite the contrary. In The Brothers Karamazov, for example, Dostoevsky's atheist, Ivan, argues against the presuppositions of Christianity with unsurpassable clarity and passion. Alyosha, aligned with the church by temperament and decision, cannot undermine a single one of his brother's arguments, although his faith remains unshakable. Dostoevsky knew and admitted that Christianity had been defeated by the rational faculty, by the intellect even, but, and this is of primary importance, he did not hide from that fact. He didn't attempt through denial or deceit or even satire to weaken the position that opposed what he believed to be most true and valuable. He instead placed action above words and addressed the problem successfully. By the novel's end, Dostoevsky has the great embodied moral goodness of Alyosha, the novitiate's courageous imitation of Christ, attain victory over the spectacular but ultimately nihilistic critical intelligence of Ivan. The Christian church described by the Grand Inquisitor is the same church pilloried by Nietzsche. Childish, sanctimonious, patriarchal, servant of the state, that church is everything rotten still objected to by modern critics of Christianity. Nietzsche, for all his brilliance, allows himself anger, but does not perhaps sufficiently temper it with judgment. This is where Dostoevsky truly transcends Nietzsche, in my estimation, where Dostoevsky's great literature transcends Nietzsche's mere philosophy. The Russian writer's Inquisitor is the genuine article in every sense. He is an opportunistic, cynical, manipulative, and cruel interrogator, willing to persecute heretics, even to torture and kill them. He is the purveyor of a dogma he knows to be false. But Dostoevsky has Christ, the archetypal perfect man. Kiss him anyway. Equally importantly, in the aftermath of the kiss, the Grand Inquisitor leaves the door ajar so Christ can escape his pending execution. Dostoevsky saw that the great corrupt edifice of Christianity still managed to make room for the spirit of its founder. That's the gratitude of a wise and profound soul for the enduring wisdom of the West, despite its faults. It's not as if Nietzsche was unwilling to give the faith, and more particularly Catholicism, its due. Nietzsche believed that the long tradition of unfreedom characterizing dogmatic Christianity, its insistence that everything be explained within the confines of a single coherent metaphysical theory, was a necessary precondition for the emergence of the disciplined but free modern mind. As he stated in Beyond Good and Evil, the long bondage of the spirit, the persistent spiritual will to interpret everything that happened according to a Christian scheme, and in every occurrence to rediscover and justify the Christian God in every accident. All this violence, arbitrariness, severity, dreadfulness, and unreasonableness has proved itself the disciplinary means whereby the European spirit has attained its strength, its remorseless curiosity, and subtle mobility. Granted also that much irrecoverable strength and spirit had to be stifled, suffocated, and spoiled in the process. For Nietzsche and Dostoevsky alike, freedom, even the ability to act, requires constraint. For this reason, they both recognize the vital necessity of the dogma of the church. The individual must be constrained, molded, even brought close to destruction by a restrictive, coherent, disciplinary structure before he or she can act freely and competently. Dostoevsky, with his great generosity of spirit, granted to the church, corrupt as it might be, a certain element of mercy, a certain pragmatism. He admitted that the spirit of Christ, the world-engendering logos, had historically and might still find its resting place, even its sovereignty, within that dogmatic structure. If a father disciplines his son properly, he obviously interferes with his freedom, particularly in the here and now. He puts limits on the voluntary expression of his son's being, forcing him to take his place as a socialized member of the world. Such a father requires that all that childish potential be funneled down a single pathway. In placing such limitations on his son, he might be considered a destructive force, acting as he does to replace the miraculous plurality of childhood with a single narrow actuality. But if the father does not take such action, he merely lets his son remain Peter Pan, the eternal boy, king of the lost boys, ruler of the non-existent Neverland. That is not a morally acceptable alternative. The dogma of the church was undermined by the spirit of truth strongly developed by the church itself. That undermining culminated in the death of God. But the dogmatic structure of the church was a necessary disciplinary structure. A long period of unfreedom, adherence to a singular interpretive structure, is necessary for the development of a free mind. Christian dogma provided that unfreedom. But the dogma is dead, at least to the modern Western mind. Perished along with God. What has emerged from behind its corpse, however, and this is an issue of central importance, is something even more dead, something that was never alive even in the past, nihilism, as well as an equally dangerous susceptibility to new, totalizing utopian ideas. It was in the aftermath of God's death that the great collective horrors of communism and fascism sprang forth, as both Dostoevsky and Nietzsche predicted they would. Nietzsche, for his part, posited that individual human beings would have to invent their own values in the aftermath of God's death. But this is the element of his thinking that appears weakest psychologically. We cannot invent our own values, because we cannot merely impose what we believe on our souls. This was Carl Jung's great discovery, made in no little part because of his intense study of the problems posed by Nietzsche. We rebel against our own totalitarianism as much as that of others. I cannot merely order myself to action, and neither can you. I will stop procrastinating, I say, but I don't. I will eat properly, I say, but I don't. I will end my drunken misbehavior, I say, but I don't. I cannot merely make myself over in the image constructed by my intellect, particularly if that intellect is possessed by an ideology. I have a nature, and so do you, and so do we all. We must discover that nature and contend with it before making peace with ourselves. What is it that we most truly are? What is it that we could most truly become, knowing who we most truly are? We must get to the very bottom of things before such questions can be truly answered. Doubt, past mere nihilism. 300 years before Nietzsche, the great French philosopher René Descartes set out on an intellectual mission to take his doubt seriously, to break things apart, to get to what was essential, to see if he could establish or discover a single proposition impervious to his skepticism. He was searching for the foundation stone on which proper being could be established. Descartes found it, as far as he was concerned, in the I who thinks, the I who is aware, as expressed in his famous dictum, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. But that I had been conceptualized long before. Thousands of years ago, the aware I was the all-seeing eye of Horus, the great Egyptian sun and sun god, who renewed the state by attending to and then confronting its inevitable corruption. Before that, it was the creator god Marduk of the Mesopotamians, whose eyes encircled his head and who spoke forth words of world-engendering magic. During the Christian epoch, the eye transformed into the Logos, the word that speaks order into being at the beginning of time. It might be said that Descartes merely secularized the Logos, turning it, more explicitly, into that which is aware and thinks. That's the modern self, simply put. But what exactly is that self? We can understand, to some degree, its horrors, if we wish to, but its goodness remains more difficult to define. The self is the great actor of evil, who strode about the stage of being as Nazi and Stalinist alike, who produced Auschwitz, Buchenwald, Dachau, and the multiplicity of the Soviet gulags. And all of that must be considered with dread seriousness. But what is its opposite? What is the good that is the necessary counterpart of that evil, that is made more corporeal and comprehensible by the very existence of that evil? And here we can state with conviction and clarity that even the rational intellect, that faculty so beloved of those who hold traditional wisdom in contempt, is at minimum something closely and necessarily akin to the archetypal dying and eternally resurrected God, the eternal savior of humanity, the Logos itself. The philosopher of science, Karl Popper, certainly no mystic, regarded thinking itself as a logical extension of the Darwinian process. A creature that cannot think must solely embody its being. It can merely act out its nature, concretely, in the here and now. If it cannot manifest in its behavior what the environment demands while doing so, it will simply die. But that is not true of human beings. We can produce abstracted representations of potential modes of being. We can produce an idea in the theater of the imagination. We can test it out against our other ideas, the ideas of others, or the world itself. If it falls short, we can let it go. We can, in Popper's formulation, let our ideas die in our stead. Then the essential part, the creator of those ideas, can continue onward, now untrammeled by comparison with error. Faith in the part of us that continues across those deaths is a prerequisite to thinking itself. Now, an idea is not the same thing as a fact. A fact is something that is dead in and of itself. It has no consciousness, no will to power, no motivation, no action. There are billions of dead facts. The internet is a graveyard of dead facts. But an idea that grips a person is alive. It wants to express itself, to live in the world. It is for this reason that the depth psychologists, Freud and Jung, paramount among them, insisted that the human psyche was a battleground for ideas. An idea has an aim. It wants something. It posits a value structure. An idea believes that what it is aiming for is better than what it has now. It reduces the world to those things that aid or impede its realization, and it reduces everything else to irrelevance. An idea defines figure against ground. An idea is a personality, not a fact. When it manifests itself within a person, it has a strong proclivity to make of that person its avatar, to impel that person to act it out. Sometimes that impulsion, possession is another word, can be so strong that the person will die rather than allowing the idea to perish. This is, generally speaking, a bad decision, given that it is often the case that only the idea need die and that the person with the idea can stop being its avatar, change his or her ways, and continue. To use the dramatic conceptualization of our ancestors, it is the most fundamental convictions that must die, must be sacrificed, when the relationship with God has been disrupted, when the presence of undue and often intolerable suffering, for example, indicates that something has to change. This is to say nothing other than that the future can be made better if the proper sacrifices take place in the present. No other animal has ever figured this out, and it took us untold hundreds of thousands of years to do it. It took further eons of observation and hero worship, and then millennia of study to distill that idea into a story. It then took additional vast stretches of time to assess that story, to incorporate it, so that we can now simply say, if you are disciplined and privilege the future over the present, you can change the structure of reality in your favor. But how best to do that? In 1984, I started down the same road as Descartes. I did not know it was the same road at the time, and I'm not claiming kinship with Descartes, who is rightly regarded as one of the greatest philosophers of all time. But I was truly plagued with doubt. I had outgrown the shallow Christianity of my youth by the time I could understand the fundamentals of Darwinian theory. After that, I could not distinguish the basic elements of Christian belief from wishful thinking. The socialism that soon afterward became so attractive to me as an alternative proved equally insubstantial. With time, I came to understand, through the great George Orwell, that much of such thinking found its motivation in hatred of the rich and successful, instead of true regard for the poor. Besides, the socialists were more intrinsically capitalist than the capitalists. They believed just as strongly in money. They just thought that if different people had the money, the problems plaguing humanity would vanish. This is simply untrue. There are many problems that money does not solve, and others that it makes worse. Rich people still divorce each other and alienate themselves from their children and suffer from existential angst and develop cancer and dementia and die alone and unloved. Recovering addicts cursed with money blow it all in a frenzy of snorting and drunkenness, and boredom weighs heavily on people who have nothing to do. I was simultaneously tormented by the fact of the Cold War. It obsessed me. It gave me nightmares. It drove me into the desert, into the long night of the human soul. I could not understand how it had come to pass that the world's two great factions aimed mutual assured destruction at each other. Was one system just as arbitrary and corrupt as the other? Was it a mere matter of opinion? Were all value structures merely the clothing of power? Was everyone crazy? Just exactly what happened in the 20th century, anyway? How was it that so many tens of millions had to die, sacrificed to the new dogmas and ideologies? How was it that we discovered something worse, much worse, than the aristocracy and corrupt religious beliefs that communism and fascism sought so rationally to supplant? No one had answered those questions, as far as I could tell. Like Descartes, I was plagued with doubt. I searched for one thing, anything, I could regard as indisputable. I wanted a rock upon which to build my house. It was doubt that led me to it. I once read of a particularly insidious practice at Auschwitz. A guard would force an inmate to carry a 100-pound sack of wet salt from one side of the large compound to the other, and then to carry it back. "Arbeit macht frei," said the sign over the camp entrance. "Work will set you free." And the freedom was death. Carrying the salt was an act of pointless torment. It was a piece of malevolent art. It allowed me to realize with certainty that some actions are wrong. Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote definitively and profoundly about the horrors of the 20th century, the tens of millions who were stripped of employment, family, identity, and life. In his Gulag Archipelago, in the second part of the second volume, he discussed the Nuremberg trials, which he considered the most significant event of the 20th century. The conclusion of those trials? There are some actions that are so intrinsically terrible that they run counter to the proper nature of human being. This is true essentially, cross-culturally, across time and place. These are evil actions. No excuses are available for engaging in them. To dehumanize a fellow being, to reduce him or her to the status of a parasite, to torture and to slaughter with no consideration of individual innocence or guilt, to make an art form of pain, that is wrong. What can I not doubt? The reality of suffering. It brooks no arguments. Nihilists cannot undermine it with skepticism. Totalitarians cannot banish it. Cynics cannot escape from its reality. Suffering is real, and the artful infliction of suffering on another, for its own sake, is wrong. That became the cornerstone of my belief. Searching through the lowest reaches of human thought and action, understanding my own capacity to act like a Nazi prison guard or a Gulag Archipelago trustee, or a torturer of children in a dungeon, I grasped what it meant to take the sins of the world onto oneself. Each human being has an immense capacity for evil. Each human being understands a priori, perhaps not what is good, but certainly what is not. And if there is something that is not good, then there is something that is good. If the worst sin is the torment of others, merely for the sake of the suffering produced, then the good is whatever is diametrically opposed to that. The good is whatever stops such things from happening. Meaning as the higher good. It was from this that I drew my fundamental moral conclusions. Aim up. Pay attention. Fix what you can fix. Don't be arrogant in your knowledge. Strive for humility, because totalitarian pride manifests itself in intolerance, oppression, torture, and death. Become aware of your own insufficiency, your cowardice, malevolence, resentment, and hatred. Consider the murderousness of your own spirit before you dare accuse others and before you attempt to repair the fabric of the world. Maybe it's not the world that's at fault. Maybe it's you. You've failed to make the mark. You've missed the target. You've fallen short of the glory of God. You've sinned. And all of that is your contribution to the insufficiency and evil of the world. And, above all, don't lie. Don't lie about anything. Ever. Lying leads to hell. It was the great and the small lies of the Nazi and communist states that produced the deaths of millions of people. Consider then that the alleviation of unnecessary pain and suffering is a good. Make that an axiom. To the best of my ability, I will act in a manner that leads to the alleviation of unnecessary pain and suffering. You have now placed at the pinnacle of your moral hierarchy a set of presuppositions and actions aimed at the betterment of being. Why? Because we know the alternative. The alternative was the 20th century. The alternative was so close to hell that the difference is not worth discussing. And the opposite of hell is heaven. To place the alleviation of unnecessary pain and suffering at the pinnacle of your hierarchy of value is to work to bring about the kingdom of God on earth. That's a state and a state of mind at the same time. Jung observed that the construction of such a moral hierarchy was inevitable, although it could remain poorly arranged and internally self-contradictory. For Jung, whatever was at the top of an individual's moral hierarchy was, for all intents and purposes, that person's ultimate value. That person's God. It was what the person acted out. It was what the person believed most deeply. Something enacted is not a fact or even a set of facts. Instead, it's a personality, or more precisely, a choice between two opposing personalities. It's Sherlock Holmes or Moriarty. It's Batman or the Joker. It's Superman or Lex Luthor, Charles Francis Xavier or Magneto, and Thor or Loki. It's Abel or Cain, and it's Christ or Satan. If it's working for the ennobling of being, for the establishment of paradise, then it's Christ. If it's working for the destruction of being, for the generation and propagation of unnecessary suffering and pain, then it's Satan. That's the inescapable, archetypal reality. Expedience is the following of blind impulse. It's short-term gain. It's narrow and selfish. It lies to get its way. It takes nothing into account. It's immature and irresponsible. Meaning is its mature replacement. Meaning emerges when impulses are regulated, organized, and unified. Meaning emerges from the interplay between the possibilities of the world and the value structure operating within that world. If the value structure is aimed at the betterment of being, the meaning revealed will be life-sustaining. It will provide the antidote for chaos and suffering. It will make everything matter. It will make everything better. If you act properly, your actions allow you to be psychologically integrated now and tomorrow and into the future, while you benefit yourself, your family, and the broader world around you. Everything will stack up and align along a single axis. Everything will come together. This produces maximal meaning. This stacking up is a place in space and time whose existence we can detect with our ability to experience more than is simply revealed here and now by our senses, which are obviously limited to their information gathering and representational capacity. Meaning trumps expedience. Meaning gratifies all impulses, now and forever. That's why we can detect it. If you decide that you are not justified in your resentment of being, despite its inequity and pain, you may come to notice things you could fix to reduce, even by a bit, some unnecessary pain and suffering. You may come to ask yourself, what should I do today? In a manner that means, how could I use my time to make things better instead of worse? Such tasks may announce themselves as the pile of undone paperwork that you could attend to, the room that you could make a bit more welcoming, or the meal that could be a bit more delicious and more gratefully delivered to your family. You may find that if you attend to these moral obligations, once you have placed make the world better at the top of your value hierarchy, you experience ever-deepening meaning. It's not bliss. It's not happiness. It is something more like atonement for the criminal fact of your fractured and damaged being. It's payment of the debt you owe for the insane and horrible miracle of your existence. It's how you remember the Holocaust. It's how you make amends for the pathology of history. It's adoption of the responsibility for being a potential denizen of hell. It is willingness to serve as an angel of paradise. Expedience. That's hiding all the skeletons in the closet. That's covering the blood you just spilled with a carpet. That's avoiding responsibility. It's cowardly and shallow and wrong. It's wrong because mere expedience, multiplied by many repetitions, produces the character of a demon. It's wrong because expedience merely transfers the curse on your head to someone else or to your future self in a manner that will make your future and the future generally worse instead of better. There is no faith and no courage and no sacrifice in doing what is expedient. There is no careful observation that actions and presuppositions matter or that the world is made of what matters. To have meaning in your life is better than to have what you want, because you may neither know what you want nor what you truly need. Meaning is something that comes upon you of its own accord. You can set up the preconditions. You can follow meaning when it manifests itself, but you cannot simply produce it as an act of will. Meaning signifies that you are in the right place, at the right time, properly balanced between order and chaos, where everything lines up as best it can at that moment. What is expedient works only for the moment. It's immediate, impulsive, and limited. What is meaningful, by contrast, is the organization of what would otherwise merely be expedient into a symphony of being. Meaning is what is put forth more powerfully than mere words can express by Beethoven's Ode to Joy, a triumphant bringing forth from the void of pattern after pattern upon beautiful pattern, every instrument playing its part, disciplined voices layered on top of that, spanning the entire breadth of human emotion, from despair to exhilaration. Meaning is what manifests itself when the many levels of being arrange themselves into a perfectly functioning harmony, from atomic microcosm to cell to organ to individual to society to nature to cosmos, so that action at each level beautifully and perfectly facilitates action at all, such that past, present, and future are all at once redeemed and reconciled. Meaning is what emerges beautifully and profoundly, like a newly formed rosebud opening itself out of nothingness into the light of sun and God. Meaning is the lotus striving upward through the dark lake depths, through the ever-clearing water, blooming forth on the very surface, revealing within itself the golden Buddha himself, perfectly integrated, such that the revelation of the divine will can make itself manifest in his every word and gesture. Meaning is when everything there is comes together in an ecstatic dance of single purpose, the glorification of a reality so that no matter how good it has suddenly become, it can get better and better and better, more and more deeply, forever into the future. Meaning happens when that dance has become so intense that all the horrors of the past, all the terrible struggle engaged in by all of life and all of humanity to that moment, becomes a necessary and worthwhile part of the increasingly successful attempt to build something truly mighty and good. Meaning is the ultimate balance between, on the one hand, the chaos of transformation and possibility, and on the other, the discipline of pristine order, whose purpose is to produce out of the attendant chaos a new order that will be even more immaculate and capable of bringing forth a still more balanced and productive chaos and order. Meaning is the way, the path of life more abundant, the place you live when you are guided by love and speaking truth, and when nothing you want or could possibly want takes any precedence over precisely that. Do what is meaningful, not what is expedient. Rule 8. Tell the truth, or, at least, don't lie. Truth in No Man's Land. I trained to become a clinical psychologist at McGill University in Montreal. While doing so, I sometimes met my classmates on the grounds of Montreal's Douglas Hospital, where we had our first direct experiences with the mentally ill. The Douglas occupies acres of land and dozens of buildings. Many are connected by underground tunnels to protect workers and patients from the interminable Montreal winters. The hospital once sheltered hundreds of long-term in-house patients. This was before antipsychotic drugs and the large-scale deinstitutionalization movements of the late 60s all but closed down the residential asylums, most often dooming the now freed patients to a much harder life on the streets. By the early 80s, when I first visited the grounds, all but the most seriously afflicted residents had been discharged. Those who remained were strange, much damaged people. They clustered around the vending machines scattered throughout the hospital's tunnels. They looked as if they had been photographed by Diane Arbus or painted by Hieronymus Bosch. One day, my classmates and I were all standing in line. We were awaiting further instruction from the straight-laced German psychologist who ran the Douglas Clinical Training Program. A long-term inpatient, fragile and vulnerable, approached one of the other students, a sheltered, conservative young woman. The patient spoke to her in a friendly, childlike manner and asked, "Why are you all standing here? What are you doing? Can I come along with you?" My classmate turned to me and asked uncertainly, "What should I say to her?" She was taken aback, just as I was, by this request, coming from someone so isolated and hurt. Neither of us wanted to say anything that might be construed as a rejection or reprimand. We had temporarily entered a kind of no man's land, in which society offers no ground rules or guidance. We were new clinical students, unprepared to be confronted on the grounds of a mental hospital by a schizophrenic patient asking a naive, friendly question about the possibility of social belonging. The natural conversational give and take between people attentive to contextual cues was not happening here either. What exactly were the rules in such a situation, far outside the boundaries of normal social interaction? What exactly were the options? There were only two, as far as I could quickly surmise. I could tell the patient a story designed to save everyone's face, or I could answer truthfully. We can only take 8 people in our group, would have fallen into the first category, as would have, we are just leaving the hospital now. Neither of these answers would have bruised any feelings, at least on the surface, and the presence of the status differences that divided us from her would have gone unremarked. But neither answer would have been exactly true, so I didn't offer either. I told the patient as simply and directly as I could that we were new students, training to be psychologists, and that she couldn't join us for that reason. The answer highlighted the distinction between her situation and ours, making the gap between us greater and more evident. The answer was harsher than a well-crafted white lie. But I already had an inkling that untruth, however well-meant, can produce unintended consequences. She looked crestfallen and hurt, but only for a moment.